Our keynote interview is up next, and we're fortunate to have with us Neil Thompson, the brand new head of Brookfield's London office business. Unarguably, Brookfield has been the City of London's most active developer since the start of the financial crisis, with a mind-blowing portfolio, including 100 Bishopsgate and Principal Place that are still under construction, and existing towers in the sky, such as Aldgate Tower and City Point. Neil was previously executive director at Great Portland Estates, where he oversaw some of its most successful developments. He's also the former chairman of the Westminster Property Association and the past president of the British Council of... I was going to say shopping centres, but that definitely can't be right, British Council of Offices. And I'm hoping that he's here over there, which he is, which is great. Neil, congratulations on your new role. First off, tell us, you know, what attracted you to be joining Brookfield?
Well, I think that the thing that attracted me to Brookfield is, my view is business is all about the people. And if you look at Brookfield as a leading property investor, the opportunity to work with people like Rick Clark, Brian Kingston, Bruce Flatt in terms of being an investor... in real estate, I mean, these guys are absolutely the top people in their field. So an opportunity to go into an organisation and work with people like that on a London business, which ultimately we're looking to grow and we're looking to take further forward, was the key attraction. And quite frankly, if you look at a platform like Brookfield and a city like London, it doesn't get much better than that.
And working with those guys, how's it been so far? How have their first 100 days? How long has it been?
Yeah, it's been about 100 days. I mean, it's just sort of just over 3 months. Look, I mean, to be clear, it's a different business to the business I was in at GPE. The scale is quite significant, and therefore that comes with various different approaches. It's a global business from one point of view. I mean, GPE was very much a London business that invested in a certain area. We were 80% in the West End. From the Brookfield point of view, it's been about learning the culture of the organisation, learning how that organisation ultimately aims to invest. But the principles in terms of are the same. Ultimately, as a business, we're looking to try and invest our investors' capital into new opportunities that we can create a total return on, which is significantly better than the market and better than our competitors. And ultimately, that's what we're aiming to do. And again, going back to the people point, Brookfield have got the right people to do that, and ultimately working with the team of people there and the executives there, they've done it over many, many years. They've got a great track record, and I'm hoping to be part of that.
Is it worth just clarifying the parameters of your role? Because obviously Brookfield in London owns a lot of offices, a hell of a lot of offices in Canary Wharf as well, but that's not you,
no.
Certainly for the time being.
No, so the situation with Brookfield in London is that we do have two platforms. So the platform that I run is essentially the Brookfield Property Partners platform. So that's a BPY company. That is part of the listed vehicle, which is listed in New York and also on the Toronto Stock Exchange. In addition to that platform in London, there is also our shareholding in Canary Wharf. So the situation with Canary Wharf is that BPY bought into 50% of Canary Wharf with the Qatar Investment Authority in 2014. That deal was done as a joint venture. So they've inherited with that deal a management team which is run by Sir George Jakubescu, who does a great job at running Canary Wharf and has done over the course of the last 25 years. That management platform is intact, and therefore the two businesses are run separately. So my business looks after the existing assets in the City of London and anything else in London in terms of new investments, and then Sir George's business looks after all of the investments that we have in Canary Wharf.
I know we're going to be starting to look forward in a second, but can you give us a quick, very, very quick guided tour of the stellar assets that make up Brookfield City of London portfolio?
Yes. So, I mean, in terms of the asset that probably gets most focus from our business is 100 Bishopsgate. It's a building in the core of the city. It's 944,000 square feet. It's 70% let, about 18 months before it's due to complete. So from that perspective, it's been a very successful development. Some people might know that actually it was a development that GPE and Brookfield had in joint venture. We owned 50% of that building together until about 2012 when Brookfield took ownership 100%. We're building that at the moment. We're about two-thirds of the way through. It'll finish at the end of 2018. And it's got Jefferies, Freshfields and Royal Bank of Canada as the anchor tenants. So that is probably the asset that gets the most focus because it's the largest building within our portfolio. The other assets that we've got are buildings like London Wall Place, where we're building Schroders' new headquarters, which will be ready towards the end of this year for them. That building is going to be a fantastic asset. It's top quality space. We've got 99 Bishopsgate. We've got Aldgate Tower. We're just about to move Amazon into their new headquarters building in Principal Place. We've just finished that asset. It's 610,000 square feet. And Amazon will take occupation of that over the course of the next few weeks. And ultimately, between now and the middle part of 2018, Amazon will move 5,500 people into that building. So a lot of the developments that we've been doing, we're doing with Grade A tenants because ultimately they are Grade A products and they're in great locations. And at this particular moment in time, most of that portfolio, in fact, all of that portfolio is around Liverpool Street Station. So they're all within a very distinct geographical area of London. And one of the reasons I've come to Brookfield is actually to ensure that we're more of a pan-London business. So actually what we need to be doing over the course of the next couple of years is we need to be looking to try and diversify that portfolio, perhaps moving out of some of those assets in the city and ultimately looking to invest in other areas of London like the West End, like South Bank, King's Cross and other areas of London.
How long does it take to walk from the one that's furthest away from the other one?
You can do all of our portfolio in about 8 minutes. It's not far.
Very focused.
It's very focused, but it's also, I mean, it's a significant portfolio. So, you know, we're currently around about 2.2 million square feet in terms of built space. If I cast your mind forward in terms of when we're finished 100 Bishopsgate and the other developments, that portfolio is going to be about 3.5 million square feet. So it's a significant business. It just so happens that it's actually geographically in one particular location. And I think if we're sitting here in 5 years' time, I think that the portfolio will have quite a different makeup.
Okay, well, that's very exciting. So let's talk about that, where you're seeing the new opportunities. So you've done the city certainly very very comprehensively.
Sure.
Not that there won't be new opportunities, but West End next, is that kind of the obvious way to be looking?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would say we are an opportunity led investor. So from that perspective, we will go wherever opportunity exists, and certainly opportunity does exist in the City of London. So we're not going to be limited in terms of the places that we look simply because we already have a significant portfolio in the city. Certainly we'd like to look at something in the West End if the right opportunity came along, but we're not going to be limited in terms of the kind of things, the kind of geographies that we go for. So we're going to be looking for assets in the West End. We're going to be looking at assets where we can ultimately put our capital to work, where we can invest in growth areas. So, you know, we're certainly looking in terms of markets like Shoreditch and areas like that where we've got investments already, but we think there's a significant amount of growth to come in those markets. And we'll be looking essentially throughout central London to try and find those areas that are appropriate for our kind of investment.
And presumably still with a kind of development mantra that's typified the Brookfield approach?
Yes, I think that if you take yourself back 5 years, when Brookfield bought the Hammerson portfolio, they bought the Hammerson business in London in 2012, that was a very heavy development-led business, and therefore as a result of that, Brookfield has been investing in developments over the course of the last 5 years. We will continue to do that. So from our perspective, looking at the kind of returns that we're expecting to deliver for our investors, certainly in the market over the course of the next few years, we will need to be investing in heavy development opportunities, but also significant asset management opportunities in order to deliver the kind of returns that we're going to want. We're not an income buyer in terms of we're not just going to buy long-dated passive income and sit on it forever, because as most people will be able to do the maths pretty quickly, over the course of the next few years, if you're buying into London at 4%, the chances are your return will be 4%. So, you know, we're going to be in a situation where we need to actually get returns which are significantly better than that for our investors, and as a result of that, we will be looking to try and be very active with the buildings that we own, and we'll be looking to try and take risks. Clearly, you're not going to make significant levels of return unless you're prepared to take some kind of risks. And I quite like looking at the idea of the market at the moment, particularly with where things might be going over the course of the next couple of years. I think there's a number of investors out there who are quite concerned about risks. And the way I look at it is actually one man's risk is another man's opportunity. So, you know, we'll be trying to turn over stones to make sure that we're finding the right opportunities for the business, wherever that might be in London.
The
kind of, I haven't calculated it, but the average lot size of your ownership in London at the moment must be is a very, very high number, I imagine.
Yeah,
in terms of
it's going to be into the hundreds of millions of pounds. Yeah.
So how difficult is it going to be to keep replicating that on an asset by asset basis, and will you look to be more flexible?
The answer is we won't be able to replicate that. So, you know, if you think about a building like 100 Bishopsgate, as I mentioned, it's 940,000 square feet. You know, it's worth well north of £1 billion after completion. We're not going to be doing one of those every few years. Those assets don't come along very often, and therefore, from our perspective, we're going to have to look into the market and try and ultimately look for opportunities that resonate with the London market, which is more in tune with what the London market has to offer. The great thing about Brookfield, again, as a platform and as a business, we have the ability to upscale if we need to. So if another Bishopsgate does come along or an asset of that magnitude, we have the balance sheet and also the capital relationships which would allow us to go and execute one of those. But at the same time, what we don't need to do is we don't need to be doing those needle-moving deals all the time. And given the fact that you know, the average lot size in London is going to be smaller than that kind of approach, we should be doing assets which ultimately can move the needle of the London balance sheet, and as a result of that, delivering good returns to the global BPY balance sheet, because ultimately that's my objective. My objective is to run the London business to deliver a good return for the global business. You don't need to do 100 Bishopsgate and that kind of scale all the time in order to deliver a good return for the business.
And that kind of increased flexibility, Brookfield, obviously best known as an office owner and developer. Do you think that will be more flexible somewhat on the sector side as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, if you think about Brookfield's global business, yes, it's an office-based business, but also it's a significant investor in retail as well. What we tend to find in London is we tend to find that we're often looking at mixed-use developments. So we're not going to be too concerned about the idea of investing in something that has got a development or an asset management angle that might be office-led, that has a significant component in retail, but also potentially has a residential angle as well. As I said a few minutes ago, we're very much an opportunity-led investor, and if we feel there's value to be invested in some value to be had from an investment that has got mixed-use approach, and we'll go and do it. We're not going to be shy about the idea of having to be office-led, and that's certainly not something that we're going to be constrained about. Definitely not.
And would you have the in-house expertise to be looking on the residential side when that includes mixed-use that includes residential?
Yeah, we have, because at the moment we're doing a mixed-use scheme. The scheme I mentioned before, Principal Place, where Amazon are moving into, that scheme is 600,000 square feet let to Amazon, but it's also 310 residential apartments that are being built for sale. And so we're doing that at the moment. So we've got that expertise in-house already. And as a result of that, we wish to try and leverage on that expertise to make sure that we can take opportunities as they come forward. So, as I said, you know, we're doing it now, and we want to try and scale that up over the course of the next few years.
Presumably, the flexibility over geography still means within London. You're not going to see you developing offices in Glasgow or something like that, I guess.
No, I don't think so. I've got nothing against Glasgow, but I don't know anything about the office market or the commercial property market there at all. So London is going to be our focus. At the end of the day, London is probably the deepest and most complex real estate market in the world. And therefore, you know, I've always taken the view, having worked in London as a London investor for, you know, well over 20 years, there's always opportunity you can find in London. I don't think you necessarily need to go to the regions in order to do that. And again, from a Brookfield global perspective, if you think about where they invest, they're tending to invest in the major cities throughout the world in various regions. You know, Boston, New York, and Washington in North America, Toronto in Canada, you know, London, Berlin in Europe. So from that perspective, the focus has always been investing in the major global cities, and I can't see that changing over the course of the next few years.
When you're thinking about geographical focus and those particular opportunities that you want to pick up on, what will be key themes for you in terms of assessing opportunities, and what do you think the drivers behind what you look at will be?
I mean, ultimately, the key thing for us is going to be where can we invest at an appropriate risk-reward position to get us the return that our investors are looking for. That's always going to be the driving force for us. At the end of the day, we are a financially led business, and we're very financially focused in terms of our approach. So we're always going to be looking at the returns in terms of the opportunity that it can have. And of course, when you're looking for the kind of returns that our investors are looking for, which is well into the double digits rather than the sort of single digits income type return, that kind of investment is always going to come with a magnitude of risk. And therefore, the thing that we will also do whenever we're looking at a new opportunity is we'll also make sure that we fully understand the risks that we're taking at the point when we take the investment. We don't like surprises, we don't like taking things to chance too much, and as a result of that, the level of due diligence that we will go into in terms of understanding the markets that we're entering into, making sure that we're very well well versed in terms of the end users, in terms of what their requirements are, building buildings that suit their purposes, because I've always taken the view that if you're a developer and you're ultimately building buildings that do not resonate with your target audience, all you're doing is just increasing your risk profile. So we'll do a huge amount of due diligence and work to understand the target market that we're operating in, as well as understanding the risks that we're taking, both in terms of financial risks, but also in terms of operational risks, to make sure that we're investing our capital into things that will deliver the kind of returns that the investors are looking for. And quite frankly, I don't know any other business that wouldn't do the same.
Sure.
Because we are, at the end of the day, custodians of our investors' capital. They're wanting us to invest their money in order to deliver returns for them. And therefore, it's our job to make sure that we're delivering investing that capital in the right way, with a judicious approach.
How much do you think improvements in infrastructure and the kind of evolution of London from an infrastructure perspective will impact your mindset on where you choose to place your chips?
Yeah, I think it's a good point that in terms of infrastructure is a very, very important part of how we look at our business going forward. Because at the end of the day, markets move as a result of infrastructure changes. And I'm probably one of London's biggest Crossrail fans, having done a lot of work on Crossrail at GPE, but also having now got a portfolio of assets which are around Liverpool Street Station, and everyone will be aware that Liverpool Street Station is going to be a key Crossrail hub. And as a result of working on those areas over the course of the last few years, you can just see how an infrastructure project like Crossrail has begun to move markets. So as an example, at the east end of Oxford Street, where when I was with GPE, we did a lot of work down there. And on the retail side, as people will be aware, the east end of Oxford Street was always second cousin to the west end of Oxford Street, where the department stores were. But we did a few developments in that location where we managed to move the Zone A on from a tone of around about £250 per square foot to the last deal that we did with Benetton, which is right outside the proposed Crossrail station, to £750 a square foot. Now, that was a significant move in a very, very short period of time. I'd like to say it was all down to our fantastic developments and schemes, but it clearly wasn't. It was to do with the fact that Crossrail was coming in the future, and those retail occupiers wanted to be ahead of the curve and get into the market and get access to the new opportunities that Crossrail was going to bring. We're also seeing that happen in the northern part of the city as well. And I think one thing that will happen over the course of the next few years is I think we will see significant movements of West End traditional occupiers looking at places in the city that are connected to Crossrail for the simple reason that if you're locating in the northern part of the city around Liverpool Street Station, you're going to be 6 minutes away from Canary Wharf, you're going to be 6 minutes away from the West End, and the quality of the office stock available to companies around Liverpool Street and those areas is probably as good as it is anywhere else in London, if not Europe. Infrastructure like that does move markets, and therefore, from our future investment propositions, we're going to be trying to find locations where infrastructure investment is going. And again, going back to one of the theses that we apply when we're trying to invest, it's always easier to invest in areas where other people are spending money, because doing all the heavy lifting yourself is quite hard work. So if you can find areas where people are investing money into infrastructure and other major developments in the area, that's where we're going to invest, because we know that there's a good chance for those markets to move and therefore we'll achieve significant returns.
Well, I can't not bring up the B word. And as the biggest, probably the biggest owner of City of London offices, how are you feeling about Brexit, and what impact have you seen so far, largely from an occupational market perspective, really, first and foremost?
Yes, I mean, it's interesting that if you take the period immediately after the Brexit vote, the second half of 2016, there was a slowdown in the occupational market. Everybody was sitting on their hands. Everybody was wondering what was going to happen next. And there were significant levels of concern. Investors were very worried about rents dropping off a cliff and recessionary period and things like that. So, you know, the Brexit vote did create a bit of a spectre around what was happening to the market, and the brakes did get applied. I think the one thing that I would say in the short term, and we can only look at the short term at the moment, is that the first half of 2017 has been a good year in the occupational market in London. Take-up has been pretty much on a par with the 10-year average. And therefore, from that perspective, the market, I wouldn't say it's recovered, but I certainly think the market has come back to the idea of actually getting on with its business. There's no doubt that the Brexit vote is still holding concern for a number of businesses because of the uncertainty in terms of what's happening in the future. So we are seeing deals that are taking longer to do. And we are seeing perhaps some harder negotiations in terms of the deals that we're doing at the moment, possibly as a result of Brexit. But the thing we're not seeing is we're not seeing the market collapse. We've got demand at the moment in central London, which is probably a little bit below the 10-year average, but not by much, you know, maybe 500,000 square feet or so. So demand has held up reasonably well. But the thing that is actually making the market slightly more in equilibrium is the fact that the supply side and the supply pipeline is actually drying up quite quickly. And therefore, one of the impacts of Brexit has been is actually to take the appetite away from developers in the market, and therefore new decisions to build new speculative space in London are being delayed. And as a result of that, the pipeline essentially is drying up quite quickly. That's definitely one impact we've seen.
And on the investment side, we've mentioned it a fair few times already today, but obviously there's been the devaluation of sterling impact.
Yep.
There's been the underlying investment market that's seen trophies trade at kind of prices that we wouldn't really imagine. Mm. How does the current investment market impact your thinking in terms of your propensity to be selling out of the trophy assets that you have, but also how much more difficult it is to be buying into new assets?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting in terms of the market at the moment because, as you rightly say, we have had the currency adjustment and that has brought significant overseas investment into the market. So if you look at, again, the first half of 2017, 76% of the investment into London was from overseas, and the majority of that came from Asia. And it's not a surprise that the Asian investors are looking at London in terms of their opportunity to invest because of that currency switch. But also you've got to remember that if you look at yields in London on a global basis, we might talk about yields in the City of London, prime yields being sort of circa 4%. In the West End, they might be sort of 3.5% to 3.75%. Taken on a global context, those yields are actually not as tight as they are in some other markets. So in Hong Kong, as an example, you know, property yields are in the twos. And so if you're thinking about buying a prime central London grade A building in London today, and you're buying it at sort of 4%, you're actually getting a premium to your yield that you would be able to get in another part of the world. So we've seen a significant amount of capital look at London because of that currency, but also because ultimately it offers a very, very good long-term home for that cash. The thing that surprises me in the market at the moment that we haven't seen is that we haven't yet seen the adjustment between those prime yields and secondary yields happen. And the thing that I'm slightly concerned about is that a number of assets in the secondary market, i.e. those assets which are perhaps obsolete, which have perhaps got very short income, which are going to need significant amounts of capex over the course of the next few years, we haven't seen yield adjustments on those assets that I would expect at this point in the cycle. Because the gap should between prime yields and secondary yields should be increasing more than it is. And I think that's potentially where we might have some difficulty over the course of the next couple of years. Because certainly if you own short-dated income, you should be seeing some price adjustments as rents gently decline and as rent freeze move out. But that's the thing that we haven't seen yet, which I'm slightly surprised about.
You've, as you mentioned, you're developing Amazon's headquarters.
Yep.
in the city.
Yep.
You were involved in Rathbone Place, which is going to be Facebook's new headquarters. Can you tell us, give us a bit of insight into your experiences about developing for those, you know, real tech giants and what demands they have from an occupational perspective and what that means for you as a developer as to how you flex your business model and how different it is for financial occupiers?
Yeah, it's an interesting question that, because if you think about the the people who are growing jobs in London, they're not the financial services business and they're not the banks. The people who are actually growing jobs in London are people like Facebook, Amazon, Google, Apple. Those are the guys who are taking more space. As you said, I've had the benefit of actually doing significant deals with both Facebook and also on the tail end of the Amazon deal. The one thing about dealing with businesses like that is that they don't always know exactly what they want. I'm not being rude about them at all in terms of their approach, but they are growing at such a rapid rate and their headcount is growing at such a rapid rate that they don't fully understand always exactly the kind of space they want, but also how much space they want. So that's an interesting dynamic just to try and work in the building. And, you know, there's no doubt that those businesses, they do want, I think, going forward, they do want to be more flexible in terms of their approach. But the other thing that I was observed about dealing with those buildings is that those businesses, that they are incredibly demanding in terms of the specification of the assets that they want to take. Maybe 10 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the tech businesses, you know, the people might have thought that they wanted to be occupying a sort of drafty warehouse in somewhere with wooden floors and the roof might leak and the windows didn't close, because they wanted character buildings. Yes, they want characterful buildings, but the specification that they need is significant. And the reason why that has happened is because these businesses are investing a huge amount of money in technology, in their own assets. And as a result of that, one thing that the real estate industry needs to do is that we need to make sure the specification of assets that we're delivering for them keeps pace with the level of technology that they're investing in their own buildings. So the amount of resilience that they need, the amount of security that they need, the amount of cooling that they need has just gone up exponentially over the course of the last few years. And I don't see that changing. And in terms of some of the work that we've done with Amazon, all these businesses are very, very security conscious, and therefore they want to be in control of their assets. They want to understand how the assets operate. And I think from that perspective, we just need to make sure that we, again, as I mentioned before, making sure that your assets and your developments resonate with the target audience, we've got to make sure that we keep up to pace with what these guys are looking for in the future. Because if we don't do that, then our building stock is going to become increasingly obsolete, and we're not going to be basically delivering developments that achieve good returns.
But is it a two-way question with what you said at the start, that they're not always sure what they want? Is there an education going both ways? Do you have to say to them, is this really what you want? Would you like something bigger?
It absolutely is a two-way process. And I think the other thing that they want, in my view, is that they want to take buildings where the buildings are flexible enough to be adaptable. Because these guys will be looking at a base build development. And you know, we did significant variations at Rathbone Place for Facebook, as an example, because they wanted a building that feels like their building. And I think one of the things that we'll do in the future is that I think the relationships that we built up with people like Facebook and Amazon over the course of the last few years, I think we'll use those relationships better in the future to actually build buildings to order for these people, a bit more in a bespoke way. We'd like to think that over the course of our relationships, we're going to become, or Brookfield might be, developer of choice for these businesses. So we will actually find sites, we'll get planning, we'll go and work with Amazon and Facebook and others, and we'll build buildings that resonate exactly with their requirements. It'll be better for them, it'll be better for us, we'll be taking less risk, but also they will get the buildings that they want. And I think that close collaboration between developers and major occupiers is going to happen more and more over the course of the next few years. And again, the other reason why that's going to happen is because the pipeline of available opportunities for businesses like this is actually going to close down. So people like Amazon and Facebook, they should be talking to businesses like Brookfield, because ultimately we can deliver solutions for them.
You've used the word flexibility a couple of times there.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah. we've touched on serviced offices once or twice today. How do you see the rise of serviced offices fitting in with the Brookfield model going forwards? You guys don't have a serviced office business per se yourselves at the moment. How do you see you guys interacting, having them in your buildings, or you operating your own flexible model? What's the future of that for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we don't have a serviced office business, but we have done work with businesses like Office Group and WeWork. This is a personal thing. I mean, I've always been reluctant to necessarily do a lot of work with serviced office businesses because I always think, well, if I'm giving them the building and then making money out of my building afterwards, well, why aren't we getting that return for ourselves? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we own the asset, and therefore we should be maximising the return for Brookfield rather than necessarily for the serviced office business. I think going forward, again, it comes back to giving the market ultimately what it wants. What we're finding that the market wants at the moment in terms of flexible space is that most businesses want a base take because they want to be in control of their own space. So they might take 80% of their space on a standard lease, 10 years, 15 years, etc., because they know ultimately over that period of time that they're going to need to have at least that amount of space in their building. The other 20% of their space take, they probably want 10% of that to be on what they would consider to be flexible terms, which might be space that they can take on anywhere between sort of 1 to 5 years, because that might be space that they need for expansion up and down as they go through the business cycle. And then the final 10% is what they would probably refer to as things like superflex, where they actually need that on maybe even 1 to 3 months' notice, for the simple reason that they might be doing a specific project, or they might have a piece of business or a pitch or something that they might be doing when they need the space. But then ultimately, once that project or that pitch and that work is finished, they then want to be able to provide it back to the landlord. So that's the kind of understanding that I've got in terms of how these businesses wish to operate. And the way that Brookfield can try and operate with these businesses is that, again, we can work with them at an early stage. We can provide them with their 80% base take in terms of the building. We can give them the flexible space that they want. And the key thing about us providing them with the flexible space and the things the occupiers will need to recognise is that the more flexibility they want within the arrangements, the more expensive the space is going to get. So the base take is going to be at a certain price. The flexible space will be at another price point, which is quite a bit higher. And then the super flex space will ultimately need to be higher still, because the more risk that we're taking in terms of the income that we can achieve on that space, the higher the price that the occupier will need to take. And I think what we're finding when we're talking to these businesses is that those varying price points in terms of super flex and flex, as long as they know that they're not long-term commitments and they can get out of them if they need to, they're prepared to pay for that flexibility. And this is why we've seen the rise of businesses in London like WeWork and the Office Group, who are doing extremely well at the moment, because they are providing that flexibility for those businesses, and they're getting paid accordingly. How we do that, we're still working it through, but it's more likely that we're going to be providing space in that kind of way rather than necessarily building up a serviced office business ourselves. It's very difficult to build up a serviced office business from scratch. We don't necessarily have those skills, certainly in London, and from that perspective, we think we can provide the occupiers what they want, but within the assets that we already have.
Right, well, I've cross-examine Neil quite enough. Who would like to ask a question? This gentleman over there, please.
So in the last panel we were talking about the funding market in the last panel that we had, and there was a lot of discussion about how difficult it is to fund speculative office development in central London. So it'd be good to hear your view on how you funded a number of your large schemes.
So in terms of the schemes that we've got going at the moment, I mean, clearly they have been funded using a balance of equity and debt. The one thing that I would say is that, and this is a very pleasing statement from my perspective, I've been very encouraged but also very happy with the arrangements that Brookfield have got with their lending banks. I mean, quite frankly, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the relationships that Brookfield has, given its size and its scale and its reach with some of the major lending banks throughout the world, is quite phenomenal. And as a result of that, us as a sponsor, when we go and have a conversation with some of these major organisations, they're very, very happy with the Brookfield business plans that we provide. And I think we probably have better arrangements in the market than most other people. In relation to the developments that we've done to date, the vast majority of those developments, with the exception of 100 Bishopsgate, which was started speculatively, have been pre-let. And therefore, as a result of that, we've been able to borrow construction finance against the pre-let income. And so we've managed to do them that way. With 100 Bishopsgate, that building was started on a speculative basis by Brookfield using its balance sheet. But as a result of the pre-letting that we've put in place, it's now over 70% pre-let. We've been able to put a significant and very, very good construction finance arrangement into that asset on the back of the pre-letting that we've been that we've done.
100 Bishopsgate, you've done purely speculatively, but in general, are you looking for a certain level of pre-let before you start development? Obviously, it's a little bit of a movable feast.
Yeah, it is a movable feast. I think that it's a very difficult question to answer that, because every single asset is different, and every single asset is going to have its different threshold. My view would be that if you're doing something which is going to be, say 100 or 200,000 square feet, then we may well be prepared to commit to that speculatively, subject to our view on market conditions. But if you're building something that's 500,000 square feet to 1,000,000 square feet, then it's very rare to be in a position where you will commit to something like that on a speculative basis. And normally, we will be looking to try and pre-let a proportion of the asset before we commit to the development in full. And that proportion will depend on, as I said, our view on market conditions, but also the particular asset and the location of that asset, and the prospects of actually leasing the remaining part during the course of construction. One of the things that you have to have a view on when you're looking at that kind of thing, of course, is that how long is the building going to take to build? But also, what is the lead-in time for the pre-let tenants? And what we're finding at the moment, again, going back to my point about the supply pipeline over the course of the next few years being relatively thin for major schemes, we've already got discussions going on with tenants who are looking to occupy space in 2022. So, we've now got discussions which are happening and beginning to emerge for occupiers who are not even thinking about taking buildings for 5 years. That is as long as I can ever remember in terms of the property cycle. Normally people will be out there looking for pre-let opportunities 2.5 to 2 years out. We're now in a situation where we're talking about opportunities which are even 5 years out.
Wow. Who else would like to ask a question? This gentleman here. That was my reserve question, if nobody asked a question. So, good question.
Placemaking is a very, very important part of how we approach our schemes. I'm a great believer in the fact that every pound that you put into public realm or placemaking, you will get back many times in terms of the value of the asset that you ultimately create. And I think creating an environment that occupiers want to be at will ultimately mean that your building will let quicker, you will reduce the risk, and you'll ultimately get a higher rent. And a great example of that for us is Principal Place, where we're putting a huge amount of money into the placemaking and into the area around the Amazon building. And I think that will make a significant difference as to how that market operates in the future. In terms of when it comes in, it comes in at the very, very beginning. It comes in even before, from our perspective, even before we bought the asset. Because when we're looking at something new as a new opportunity, if we're going to maximise our position in terms of the capital that we're going to employ in a building, as I've said, if placemaking is going to significantly add to that level of return, we want to know that at the very, very beginning. And therefore, we'll bring placemaking into our business plan even before we potentially bought an asset. And that actually goes with a lot of things that we would think about which ultimately deliver and drive value for a building. So including the marketing in terms of how we would approach the marketing for a certain asset, we even think of that potentially before we've even started, for the simple reason that this is about presenting a package to a tenant, something that they're ultimately going to be very happy to occupy, something they're going to be very happy to take for a long time and pay a high rent, and therefore the idea of making sure that the placemaking works, the marketing approach works, and ultimately the tenant gets everything that they want is something that we have to be confident that we can deliver at the very beginning of the process. And the other thing I would add on placemaking is that we've spent a lot of time, as David mentioned, I was chairman of Westminster Property Association before I left GPE. I spent a huge amount of time with Westminster City Council encouraging them to do placemaking in Westminster. And one thing I did over the course of the last 5 years, I was pushing very hard for Westminster to ensure that when Crossrail completed, that the places around the Crossrail stations were actually repaired and improved, and therefore those assets came out the other side in a better place than when they went in. And I'm pleased to say that the scheme that we did at Hanover Square will deliver that. And certainly on the east end of Oxford Street, we spent a huge amount on placemaking as well. And the one thing I'm doing with now coming over to work in the city is we're having regular conversations with the city about how we as a business can invest our money into placemaking in the city, because we ultimately believe that that's going to be beneficial for all of us.
Any more for any more? Right, well, I think we've tortured Neil enough. I think he's gives a very thorough explanation of things ahead. So thank you so much for joining us, Neil, and please thank him in the usual way.
Great, thank you. Cheers, David. How are you doing? You think you're holding up all right?